When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Roker Report podcast in association with Volk's Brewery. Today, we're joined by a very special guest who formed part of a record-breaking Sunderland defence in 1998 to 1999 and formed a formidable partnership with the likes of Andy Melville and Steve Bould. Welcome to the show, Paul Butler. How are you doing, Paul? You well?
Yeah, good. Apart from the four-hour drive up, but good. Yeah, it was I won't go the A19 again, but no.
Stuck in traffic.
It's traffic A19. I understand now why they call them the smog monsters down that side, don't they? So it's not a nice drive at A19.
No, it's really not. I want to start off on what you're doing at the moment. Normally we start in a different order, but we were having a bit of a chat off air, and I believe you're doing some grassroots stuff at the moment.
Yeah, I'm busy at the moment. I run my own college. I've done that 4 years now, 16 to 18s are from that. They're not going to be footballers in the sense of professional footballers, but what they do A-levels, B-techs, and then they go to America at the age of 18. So I've been part of that 4 years. I've 16 to 18 lads I've had out into America, so pathway of doing that. I do that Monday, Tuesday and a Wednesday, which I enjoy the coaching and doing that involved. And then I do the recruitment for Liverpool. I've been Man City 5 years prior to that, doing 14s to 18s. Left them 2 years ago because one thing and another in the sense of it's a long story, could probably take another podcast to do it, but a long story, being a City fan, it was hard to leave, but I had to leave to progress me, and then I moved across to Liverpool and loving it. 2 years now in there, working with 18s, 21s, 23 year olds that were identifying and going all around the world looking at players. And on top of that, I'm ambassador of a grassroots club, so I've always been involved in grassroots since my kids have gone through it, and see how vital it is to raise money for them, because as much as the FA tell you the money's not out there.
No.
And they'll give you a grant every 2 or 3 years, but if you want to raise 6s, 8s and 10s girls teams, you've got to put your hand in your pocket and raise it yourself. And that's what we've been doing. Yeah.
Is there a way that people can donate?
There is a way, but what we try to do on the charity side of it, we use a WhatsApp group.
Yeah,
we find it a lot easier than actually going out to a charity, and it's mental, but we try and use a WhatsApp group. So anybody that wants to contact me through my Facebook, I'll give them the lead through my own Facebook. So if you send me, I've got hundreds now of Sunderland fans. I've constantly, over the past 5 years, I've gone on Facebook, and my sons, who were 23 and 21, like, Dad, you should go on Facebook. I said, I don't want to go on Facebook. And anyway, 4 or 5 years ago, I'm on Facebook now. So anybody wants to send me a friend's request, and I'll send them the details that way.
Perfect. Good, mate. We'll start with a nice, easy one. Although I say this is an easy one, and everyone I've asked has gone, it's a difficult one. But it was a good drinking squad, as I know from speaking to a few people. But who was the best? Who was the best drinker in the
player
entire
squad? Or staff?
Either, we'll take either.
I couldn't go into the staff, but we had a good bond where the players would go out with the staff as well. So it was brilliant. That's why we're so good. But everyone probably says the same with it all. Quinny was up there. Andy Melville was up there.
That surprised me, Mel.
Yeah, Mel was up there. Who else would have been in that squad? Mel, Dickie Ord would have been up there at the time.
Dick Yord doesn't surprise
me. And I'll probably come a close third or fourth.
Apparently Kevin Phillips was better.
Kevin was a secret assassin. He was on a pitch. You won't see how many he was drinking, but he'd put a few away.
A few away the other week. We did a talking, and it surprises me how quick he can put them away for his size.
He puts them away. The worst drinker is probably Mickey Gray.
That doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
2 pints, you fall asleep, and then wake up 3 hours afterwards. That's typical Mickey.
It's we'll go back to like 1998 when you joined. I think we're just talking off air before you joined the same day as Tommy Sorensen. As a fan, I remember quite well. We narrowly missed out on promotion at the Premier League. Reedy's looking for, basically, as far as I remember, he had Craddock and Williams. And I think he wanted someone who was tough, uncompromising, and obviously looked towards yourself, which I think are the embodiment of probably those words at the time. Yeah. How did the move come about?
The move come around, it was a strange one. I remember playing twice against Sunderland that season for Berry.
Yeah.
And I did okay against Quinney. Do you know what I mean? You look forward, you go, now, Quinn, Ireland legend, you get up for them games. And,
yeah, absolutely.
And at the time, we knew Kev had scored goals, but Quinney was the one, you want to play well against Quinney and you want to try and... But it was a strange scenario, really, because Peter Reid used to come down quite a lot to Berry. He wasn't up here all the time in Sunderland. When he wasn't training up here, had days off, Reid would come and still train at Berry. Like, the end of his Man City career, he went and trained in at Berry with Stan Tennant, and Sam Ellis was his old number two, was Stan Tennant's number two at the time.
That's right,
Stan Tennant. So Reid always used to keep his fitness up by coming in the odd day, Monday, Tuesday, when I was at Berry, and training. It'd be random, it'd be once every month. But I didn't realise, talking to his brother Sean Reid, he was watching certain players as well as training with us at the time, which was, you probably couldn't do that now, a manager of a Premiership team training with, and then identify him. But that was through the season. So when we played against each other, nothing was said, nothing was spoken about. Come end of the season at Berry, I had 1 year to go, and Charlton had offered money for me. So I went to the playoff final, and on the principle, I was going to sign for Charlton.
So at the 98
I was at the playoff final, and I was sat in the director's box as a Charlton guest, and fast forward it, went to the toilet at half time, bumped into Sean Reid, the rest is history, as I would say.
So you're due to go to the Premiership
I was
with Charlton.
Due to go to the Premiership with Charlton, and then when the penalties finished, I'd already agreed at half time on the phone to my agent, who was in London, after speaking to Sean Reid, that there was an interest from Sunderland. And as soon as you seen the Sunderland fans, it was like, yeah, that's for me.
Yeah, good.
And that was it. And that was the honest truth of it all. And you didn't realise, I just turned the Premiership down, Mrs. went, what are you doing? I went, I know, but it's London. I already turned two moves down to Wimbledon before that. And who else was involved? Who was that around the time? I was sniffing another London club at Fulham, I think it was, something like that. I turned moves down because I didn't fancy London, in a sense. But when Sean Reid pulled us, and I didn't even speak to the missus, and I spoke to my agent. I went, get the deal on if we can. Well, what score is it? I went, I can't remember the score at half time. It was like 2-2 or whatever. I don't know.
It's actually only 1-0 at Charlton at the time, funnily enough.
I said, it doesn't matter what it's going to be. Let's get the deal on. And it was done. And then literally 2 days after the playoff final, my agent flew up from London. I drove up and I signed the contract at the Stadium of Light.
I think if I was watching that game as a neutral, I would have been put off by the gold strip.
But it was the fan base. It was a fan base in the stadium, and because I'd been here with Berry in the season, and I played against Quinn, and I seen the squad, and I thought some players in that squad, and not knocking the Charlton squad at the time, but I was going to go in and play alongside Mark Fish and that at the time. That's
Mark
what
Fish
was
in South African.
That's what they was going to partner with, and that way. So. And basically, when Reid didn't even speak to me, it was Sean Reid had done most of the deal. I come up and signed, and Reid just turned around. I said to me, he says, do you know why I brought you in? And I went, I've got an idea. I says, but you still got to go out and prove pre-season why I brought you in.
Yeah.
And I went, right, what do you want me to do? He said, just do what you do at Berry. Just defend. I want you to defend. I said, right, no problem. We'll do that. And that's how it went. So
with Reedy, I think a lot of people ask about impressions of Reedy, but the more people I speak to from that era, the more people mention to me Bobby Saxton. Like, how much of a character was Bobby Saxton?
Bobby was everything about Sunderland. Everything that was good and everything that was positive and everything that players owe their career to, especially me, in a sense of he moved me to the next level and told me own truths and told me how it is. And he spoke to you like a dad or a big brother. And he told you how it was. And I think he won't be able to work in today's society the way it is, the way HR is and stuff like that at the clubs, because you won't get away with some of the stuff Bobby used to call you. But you used to man up, you have to man up, simple as that. And Bobby told you straight away, and I like that in a coach. But Bobby was everything. Bobby was everything. He was the comfort blanket for the gaffer sometimes when gaffer needed to go and have a break for 2 or 3 days away from the squad. Sacco took training for 2 or 3 days. But we had very good coaches underneath him as well. Like Pop Robson was underneath there, and Ricky Sprays was underneath there, and Adrian Heath was underneath there, Andy King, God bless his soul. Reedy had created a tremendous staff underneath him that sometimes he didn't have to be here. He knew the staff would click on, but Sacco ran that group. He ran that. He was strong, and you could go and speak to him. You get an answer off him straight away. Yep. Whether he wanted a day off or not, he'd get to tell you. But no, he was top man, and I still speak to him now.
Thing is, with the squad at the time, I suppose, as you said, you came in and actually didn't know, but you obviously had to play a final, so you probably would have heard, you know, later on, Quinny coming out on TV and saying, you know, we're going to go and win that league and stuff like that on the TV. But although there was yourself and Tommy Sorensen that came in as like the fresh blood, shall we say, the rest of the squad kind of stayed pretty much the same.
Yeah, it didn't need much tinkering. I think what Reedy looked at was, I think Lionel Perez was leaving anyway. There's some issue with him anyway, and he was leaving. So we needed a keeper, and to go and get Tommy was a find of whatever. You talk about Kev. Yeah,
brilliant.
You talk about Kev for $500,000. Tommy will push him close for the value. Just a bit under than that. And then Jerry Harrison come in, if you remember Jerry Harrison.
I remember Jerry Harrison.
Had a health issue at the time, which nobody knew about. And to be fair, he got ridiculed for it, even off the players, because he pulled out. And then was that? I think that's the summer we brought Lee Clark in, was it?
Clarkey was the season before. Clarkey broke his leg opening day of the season, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So it wasn't too much, but the squad didn't need tinkering. Anyway, it was full of quality, and there was quality sat in the stands as well. So Reedy just needed a bit in the spine, really, a keeper, and someone that's had been at this level probably a couple of years and just knew what you were going to get.
You came from, it was a good Bury side from my memory, I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, a club that's hopefully not gone permanently, but gone at the moment. But I remember the side then, it was probably the best Bury side of the past 20 years. But coming from Bury and a good Bury side with good players, good characters, and coming to Sunderland, could you feel the level of character in the squad even the first few weeks that you were there? Because, I mean, looking back now, we had some real character and proper leaders in that team.
Because like you're saying, you just touched on it then. So Dean Kiley was our keeper at Bury at the time.
Yeah.
And I think because I didn't go to Charlton, it was 2 years after he signed him. But we had David Johnson up front. But the magic one of it all and kept us, there was two players that kept us all together, was Andy Gray. Remember Andy Gray that played for Crystal Palace? International lad, midfield lad. He played up to Falkirk.
He played
for England about 4 or 5 times. Big mates of Ian Bright and Wright. Played at the Palace, played a lot of games like that. And Stretch, Gordon Armstrong coming.
Gordon Armstrong,
He'd come in and he was a major signing for us and told me all about Sunderland all the way through the season. So I don't know if he was working to be an agent then. But no.
He's an agent now.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Yeah, he's always on the phone to me. So when I arrived, dressing rooms are the same whether it's a Premiership or Conference.
Yeah.
The banter's the same. It's ruthless. You get stick. The names are bigger. Obviously, your Nicky Summerbys of this world's in there, and your Kevin Bowles, and your Niall Quinns, and Alan Johnsons, and Mickey Gray's, all international players, they're all in there. Yeah. And the cars are a lot bigger. That's the difference.
Especially Mickey Gray's.
Mickey changed it every week. But as banter goes, no, I was a strong character, and when I was in Rochdale in my early career and went to Bury, I enjoyed the dressing room.
Yeah.
I wasn't one that feared the dressing room going every morning. I enjoyed it. And if you was to get like slagged off from it, what gear you're wearing, embrace it, grow up, that's what it's part of.
Who's the worst dressed?
Worst dressed would have probably been Quinny.
I knew you were going to say Quinny.
Horrendous stuff, but it's an easy target, Quinny. He used to wear jackets that didn't fit him, and Alex Ray used to ram in him every day. But probably the worst dressed, on top of taking Quinny out of the way, might have been probably Deitch, some of the tracksuits he'd wear.
Deitch. It was a DJ, wasn't it?
Yeah, because Deitch was a DJ and he'd come in with horrendous tracksuits that he was still in, thinks he was in Run DMC or something, and he was caps on this way. But that's in trainers. So Deitch, you know, it was good dressed to Deitch, but some of the gear he wore in training.
Questionable.
Very questionable.
You started the season alongside someone who ended up having a really good career at Sunderland, and he was having a good career up to that point.
Yeah.
Jody Craddock, obviously, and I think you were brought in to play alongside Jody, used Darren as more like a, Darren Williams, that is, as more of like a versatile player that could play right back, left back, centre off, in goal if he really wanted to, Darren Williams. But second game in, Craddock got injured and Andy Melville came in. And I know it was only the one season that you had, but it was probably Andy Melville's best. What was it that suited your game and Melville's game so well? Because you did pair together really well.
Yeah, it was a strange one, really, because when I arrived, Mel was there. I knew Andy Melville was, and I knew who Dickie was. And obviously, the gaffer Reed at the time wasn't using him, but they only had 1 year of contract to go, and they'd already been told they can leave. So they wasn't using him. But the thing is, what Reed used to do, and he was brilliant, is he never shunned him. He never put him out anywhere. Do you know what I mean? He still trained with us. He didn't do what you call a bomb squad. He kept him in because he knew that they were influential in the dressing room still. Do you know what I mean? If you didn't want them to be in bad apples, come in the dressing room. So Mel and Dickie were different class towards me, helping me settle in at the club. So when Jody got when he was injured in the second game, it was Mel was up to speed in reserve games that he'd played, training. So Mel was a total different character to me in the sense where Mel would let me go and defend, and he'd let me attack first balls, and he'd let me go and smash somebody, and he'd sweep up behind me. And Mel was a great calming influence on that, a few years older than me. Where when I played with Jody wanted to be the young one that were to go and do it. So I had to adapt my game a bit to Jody, which I could do. But then Mel was the one that wanted to come out and play from the back. And at Bury at the time, we never done that. So I was learning during the game how he was doing it. So I pick up hell of a lot from Mel. And then he just hit straight away. He come in and I think we got a clean sheet first game and we went on from there, basically. And
Tranmere, wasn't he? Scored now.
Yeah.
Fifth?
Yeah.
I think.
5-0, yeah.
My memory says
4-5-0,
right?
5-0, something like that. We beat him.
5-0,
I scored a diving head in.
That's right, yeah.
And I think I was coming back from a corner to still stay up there for that one. I don't know how I was
Martin
up there.
Smith.
That's it, yeah, put it in. Whipped it in, yeah.
Smithy put it in, and I think I'm sure it was the fifth. It was on
Facebook the other week. I reposted it, someone
put
it on.
That's right.
And then I reposted it, so I forgot all about that goal, but now they're... So, yeah, so from that, we blended, and it was what something that we never worked on in training kind of thing, even though we had a lot of 11v11s every day. But I just knew my strengths, and Mel just let me get on with it.
There was a lot of... partnerships in that team. I mean, if you look right across the team that won that league, you had yourself and Andy Melville, almost called him Mary there. You had Mickey Gray and Magic Johnson.
Yeah.
You had Summerby, Chris Macon, Quinn Phillips, and then you had a choice of Borley, Clarkey, or Alex Ray in the middle.
And then you had young Gav McCann that was just
coming
into it as well. And Gav gave us legs in there. And
great player, Gav
McCann. And you had Gav that come in. And you also had, what's it called? Come from Burnley. Big nose on him.
Oh, John Mullen.
John Mullen. Mullers, I still speak to Mullers now, and he won't be happy with that. But no, Mullers coming. So they give us the freshness in there. And underneath that, biting at there was Paul Furwell. He was chomping at. He was 17, 18, but he could. In 11v11s, you could put yourself around a bit first. So it was the new brace.
Yeah.
So we had competition all over the place. And as well as me and Mel in there, you still had Darren Williams that wanted to play and he was left out. Jody was coming back from injury. Darren Holloway could play centre half, stroke right back. Who else was in there? Martin Scott. You had up front Bridges and Deitch was understudy to Quinny and Kev. So we had a really, really good, strong 18, 19 players that on any given day, we knew if we had a bad game, we'd pull you out and you were in. So
it's slightly depressing reading out that squad now.
Yeah, no, it was good. It was a competitive squad, but a squad that got on with each other.
Yeah.
An all British base, which was even interesting.
It was. I mean, I think a lot of the time, I remember David Moyes made a comment about having a British core and then played an Irishman, which was funny. But like there was a really strong core of players that seemed to have an idea of each other's personalities and the banter that would exist right from the manager all the way down.
It was driven by Sacco. We go back to Sacco again and the gaffer Reader. They was adamant that you needed a good dressing room, a strong dressing room of characters in there, a mixture of the youth that would drive you on. But also, you needed leaders in there, and we had enough of them. Alex Ray was a character in there. He drove most of the dressing room mad. Not drove us, but drove us mad. But the most of us in there was captains at other clubs, or we'd been captains. So, but Borley was the captain. We knew that Borley, what Borley done. If Borley had run through the brick wall for you, you'd follow him.
Yeah.
And that's the way he had us, and that's the way Sacco would want you doing. So... Yeah, we had our tiffs, we had our fights, we had our arguments, we had a lot of Sterling and what's going on now with Gomez, a lot of them on the training grounds and in the dressing rooms. Let's get on with it.
I think, I can't remember who it was I spoke to, but someone's. I get the feeling it might have been Alex Ray when he did a think when he did the talking with Quinny at the stadium, and he said, said the thing is, he said, there sometimes would be a lot of like arguing between each other, and there'd be a bit of, as you said, Gomez and Sterling sort of going on. But if anyone did that towards, I think it was Darryl Powell he was talking about, if anyone did that at one of us, it was the entire team you were taking on. You weren't just taking on one player.
That was a derby game when Darryl Powell came for him.
At half time when Reedy had his shirt off.
And then he jumped behind me and he went, you saw that man in the bar afterwards when his dad's come in looking for him. And it's funny. So I've been going all day. He's got some stories, Al, on him. But no, he'd wind people up, Al. But he's a Glaswegian lad. He'd look after himself.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't fancy getting involved in a fight with him. Remember him fighting with Andy Cole?
Alex would fight with himself.
Yeah.
Put it one way, do you know what I mean? He'd fight with himself. So no, but we had a strong dressing room, and that was what driven us on, really, the dressing room and the pressure of the dressing room, players that wasn't playing. And when the reserves used to get played at the Stadium of Light, and there's 20,000 in there watching the reserves play, you're going, they're not bad away them. And then the odd game, me and Mel would get rested, Darren Williams would come in with Jody and beat Chelsea 5-0 or something. You know what I mean? We didn't play that day, we were suspended.
Funny,
So
you and Steve Bould.
That was the kind of caliber of players he had in the squad.
It's funny that game, you talk about the Chelsea game, it's like you and Steve Bould were, I think Steve Bould got a yellow card against Borough, so he was suspended. You were suspended, and then you also had, I can't remember the midfield now, but it was, I think Alex
Muller's
Ray.
I think Muller's played in there, didn't he? Or something like that. We had about four players that
Paul Thurwell, Eric Roy,
as we called him, because he was from down south and he wasn't French. He's never been French.
Very underrated was Eric Roy.
Good player.
Great player.
He took him a while to understand the English game, but clever player as well.
Yeah.
Understood. And nasty as well.
Yeah.
He could leave his foot in.
Yeah.
He could leave his foot in. But I enjoyed him. And then I only spoke to him this morning, Stefan Schwartz.
Schwartzy.
Yeah, he's brilliant. Brilliant. He's constantly supporting my grassroots stuff. He sends me messages. He sends me stuff. He's a fantastic guy. He's doing a lot for Benfica and stuff like that.
Lovely,
so,
lovely man.
But they were the characters Reedy brought in.
Yeah.
But the year we ran up, it was just, it's momentum. And I spoke to somebody the other day about momentum and how do you stop it and how do you start it? Once it's coming for you and once you get that ball rolling, and Reedy always said to us, once you get this juggernaut going, Sunderland, you're not going to stop it.
Yeah.
And we fully believed in that. And Sacco used to send me and Mal out and Tommy Sorensen and basically say, your job is clean sheet. That's it. You know we're going to score goals. So keep a clean sheet.
Yeah.
So if someone scores, we're blaming you three. And that was the responsibility he had put on you. So you knew that Kevin Quinney were going to score, or Magic could score, or Nicky had whipped one in from 40 yards out or something, or Alex Ray had score, or Ball would get a tap in or break his nose and score that way, you know. But we knew our job was basically is to defend. And that's not so much Mickey Gray defending. Mickey will let Mickey go because he's making sacks. So we always used to defend as a three. So Mickey Watted always used to go and go and go. Chris used to just back up Nicky Summerby, and it was always me and Bally sat in front. So it was the four of us that patrolled quite a lot of it. But that was our job. And when we conceded, it was horrible. It might have been 4-1. It was horrible in the dressing room because you've seen the one end of the dressing room where Quinny and Kev have got two each and you're sat at the other end and you're going, that's a clean sheet. And Tommy would be going berserk if he conceded because he wanted clean sheets every week.
Broke the clean sheet record that season.
Yeah,
I think
we got 27, 28, didn't we? It's not bad, is it? Out of 46.
Sorry. Was it good? I was, it would have been 13, 14 then. It was a decent childhood. Yeah,
I think we only conceded two goals once in that season.
Yeah.
I think so, something like that. I think it was 2-2 draw. I think we'd done.
Watford maybe maximum, I think, got past
us. I think that's what it was. But no, it was good. But it was right from the front to the back. I know we always like old cliche, well, Kevin, Quinny, but you're only as good as your strikers.
Yeah.
And if them two didn't perform, which they always did, you had Mickey Bridges and Deitch on the bench to come on.
Thing is, I'm talking about like the past, but I suppose also the future as well. I wanted to ask something in a sense. People talk an awful lot about the expectations of Sunderland fans, right?
Yeah.
Now, it hasn't changed in the past couple of years or the past 10 years or whatever. But what frustrates me is that sometimes you think people think our expectations are too high. We're in League One, which annoys me. But how did a player, like a team like yourself, who had huge expectations to go up, not just, you know, go up in the first top two, the fans thought we finished third with 90 points, won to win the league. And to say you matched those expectations, you exceeded them because we lost three games.
Yeah.
Like, why is it that team could handle the expectation and exceed it, whereas teams since and maybe teams before just seem to wilt?
It's hard because the expectation to go up, and I say this after I left, because I went to Wolves and they had been up for 20-odd years in the Premiership. And the expectation to go, you could feel it when you walked through the door at Wolves. When I first arrived at Sunderland, I couldn't feel no expectation. The lads they'd been beating a playoff final, but the atmosphere in the dressing room, first day of pre-season, driven by Bawley and the senior players of Niall Quinn and that, was right, we'll go again.
Yeah.
And me arriving, Tommy Sorensen arriving, might have given him a lift, but we weren't guaranteed. We had to go out pre-season and earn it because Reedy didn't know how well I'd cope with 40-odd thousand from going from Bury of 7,000.
Yeah.
Different style of football. But it wasn't so much of a gamble to bring me and Tommy in, but it was an educated gamble in a sense where we needed an out-and-out defender that comes in and just defends it and defends the box. And it's them 1-0 games that year, if you can have a look back on, we want many of them, but the 1-0 games we take more pride off than the 3 or 4-0 wins because the 1-0 games are close and we've had to do some defending in it, and that's what you want. But the expectations, you're not a big club. You're not a Premiership club. Just live with it.
Yeah.
Just get on with it. I know it's hard, but I think the way kids are brought up now through academies, and I've been at Man City 5 years, Liverpool 2 years, they don't get brought up at 15, 16, knowing what jobs you should be doing as an apprentice. They get brought up wanting to pick the first car. At 17, what kind of car am I driving? They haven't even kicked a ball in the 23s.
Yeah.
And them expectations are driven by agents who are in the game. Listen, there's some bad agents, but there's some good agents. But expectations for Sunderland, get on with it. It's a big club. It's a big club. I understand if I can go back 22 years, I'd sign again and the expectations would be there again. Just got to go with it. Got to live it. And the person sat next to you in the dressing room wants your place.
Yeah.
So if you don't deliver, you're out the team.
And just going to the team there. I mean, even when we just went to the subs, there was such a...
Yeah, we had depth in there, but we had character and we had a togetherness, and no one was bitter about not being... lads were disappointed, don't get me wrong. Everyone wanted to play in front of 40,000 at Stadium Alight on a Saturday. But it was a typical... If you see the rugby lads on telly when they all high-five each other and do the subs in the tunnel when they're walking out, very atmosphere. All the subs are always down. Really had everyone involved. It wasn't... Right, this is the squad of, that was only five subs at the time. This is the squad of 16. No, 20 odd of you all come down to the dressing room. And then when he named the team, which he mostly did on a Saturday, you didn't know most of the time until the Saturday, the lads who were in the suits and one in the 16 went round and shook everyone's hand.
Yeah.
And that's how it was
proper
done.
Togetherness.
Yeah, and then they went up in the players' lounge, waited up there, come back down after the game, shook our hands again. And that was it, that's how it was done.
Talking about that particular season, one thing that just kind of triggered in my mind there, do you find it quite weird that we won the league at Bury, considering you came from
Bury? It was
Bury?
A way... I'd looked at it about 3 or 4 games earlier.
Yeah.
And I'd kept in touch with Bury. I still speak to the lads. I played in the charity match 3 weeks ago to raise money for them.
Yeah.
So I'd done all that and I went back. And it's close to my heart, Bury Football Club. And it's just shambles what's going on with it, that place. But to go back there, I'm thinking to myself, they needed the points.
Yeah, because they were like near the... They were kind of near
the bottom. Yeah, they were near the bottom, about 4 from bottom at the time. They needed the points. And I think Sunderland had 3 sides of the ground that night. It was a Tuesday night. It was absolutely teeming down. And I thought to myself, you don't want Sunderland coming to you when you need points. Because we were just playing games on a Saturday, off Sunday, Monday morning, light training session, game, win. Off Wednesday, light training session Thursday, bit of set pieces Friday, win on Saturday. And it was just a momentum of rolling and rolling and rolling. And you couldn't wait for the games. That's how quick they could. So to go to Bury, I think it was a 5-2 or 5-2. 5-2.
4-1 up by half.
They were one of the clubs that scored 2 against us, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Darren Bullock, if I remember rightly.
But it was a weird scenario because the Bury fans stayed behind afterwards and clapped us as well.
Yeah.
Which was good. And I enjoyed that. And Reedy, it was a... Not one I'd say I enjoyed in a sense, because I think Bury went down, did they? Did they go down that season?
I can't quite remember, but
it wasn't through that game, but they'd done enough anyway to go down. But no, it was a surreal game. I'd spoke to some of the lads. I even went in the dressing room before the game, to the Bury dressing room, and to see them. And Reedy caught me go walking in and went, get out. Do you know what I mean? What are you doing in there? So just go and see how they are. And that's how he's done. But no, 5-2. But listen, we were creating 9-10 chances a game.
Yeah.
And Kev only needs one.
Yeah.
That's a bit.
Four
if you,
that night, didn't
and
it?
If you've seen some of his goals that night, do you see some of his finishes?
Oh, the,
do you know what I mean?
The fifth one.
We had, me and Mel had always had the best seat in the house. We was always stood 40 yards behind him, watching him going. And as soon as he left his foot, me and Mel used to say, it's a goal.
That one against Barnsley, when he just like 90th minute.
So many. There's so many. But you'd watch him in training and he'd stay behind and he'd smash a few balls and you're going, he just had a technique. And if you've got Kevin here now, he probably wouldn't know how to coach that.
Yeah.
He'd probably show you how he did it. But he's got such a low centre of gravity and how he strikes a ball and the power he can generate in a ball was like... But every time he'd have a shot, he went in that year and the year after and the year after and the year after.
And you sometimes forget with Phillips, he got 25 goals that year and he was out for three and a half months.
Yeah, he was out for a while.
Three and a half months.
Our strikers, I think Deitch and Mickey Bridges got double figures that year.
12 or 14 or something
and,
like that.
And Big Niall got a few.
20-odd,
So I think the front lot at a time got close to 60, 65 goals.
Yeah.
And that's the way Sacco used to put a board up by the start of the season. And he wanted so many goals from the strikers, so many goals from midfield, and so many goals from centre-halves and full-backs, and you had to contribute. And I think from full-backs and centre-halves, I think he wanted between 10 and 15 goals in a season. Yeah. And that season, I think, got 5 or 6. Mel got 4 or 5. Mickey got 3 or 4. And Chrissy got 1 or some of the odd one.
Like Mickey. Chrissy was the only one that didn't score that season, so, I think. That's where the
so we contributed not, but he wanted us all to score and contribute. And that was a big thing, yeah.
The season afterwards, talk about Melville, obviously great partnership, but then I have to be honest, in my lifetime, I think the season after the person that replaced him was probably the best centre-half I've personally ever seen for Sunderland.
Yeah.
But how big of an impact was Steve Bould as a character, person, and a player to you?
He was, when Mel knew he was going anyway, Mel knew it was his last year, Reedy had pulled him in February, March time, before the end of the season, knew he was going, so there was no hard things about Mel going in and he knew he was going to bring something half in. Now that summer we went up, Reedy pulled us in and he said to us, I'm bringing 2 centre halves in, maybe 3. So I went, yeah, not a problem. He says, we need 4 centre halves in Premiership. Simple as that, we need 4 centre halves. But right, okay. Didn't tell me who it was. Then when I seen it was linked to Steve Bould, I'm going, jeez, I've got to even be on the same training ground as him. I want to be in the same back fours as him. So we signed Boulder and then we signed Thomas Elmer. In the same week.
Jeez, yeah.
German international, 70-odd caps, absolutely legend. And one of the nicest guys you're ever going to meet in football. Unbelievable guy. And just so, I was the only player that played 3 or 4 games with him. He only played that many. And I played all the games with him.
Leeds, I think.
Learned so much of him. So much of a player that if you stood in here now, you go, he's not a centre-half.
Yeah.
He's not good. He was different class. A bit like Dennis Irwin, who went to Wolves and Dennis joined us. He was just cultured, everything, but he couldn't settle, his family couldn't settle, and he hung around on his own here for 6-7 months, his family went back. But going back to Boulder, funny story that we were on the training ground, and we used to do a lot of 11v11s, Reedy and Sacco, in the championship. So he kept the same thing going, so we're having 11v11, and Sacco always used to referee it, and he was the worst referee you're ever going to get. If you thought he was offside, he's onside. If you think he's onside, he's offside. Everything, just to wind you up, to see what your reaction was like. And it's a thing he used to do. Baldy wasn't, not having him, Baldy loved him. Baldy wasn't having his decisions some days in training. So I'd gone into the back four with Baldy, and it was like, and I'm looking across and Steve Bold's there, and he's going, God, he's got the presence of Quinney.
Yeah.
Do you know that stature? And he's going, it's Baldy. And I'm watching, up, drop, squeeze, drop, and that's all he was doing. Get your arm up, drop, and this is in training. So he kept playing. We was playing Mickey Bridges and Deitch offside all the time in training, and it was just him catching them all the time. Yeah. And Sacco stopped training, and he went, right, stop. I don't want you playing offside anymore. So Baldy went, why? I'm catching him. Yeah, but you're going to get caught in the Premiership. It's going to happen. You're going to get caught. You put your hand up, it's going to get caught. I've been at Arsenal for 10 years and we played offside and catch everyone offside. So we're outside. We're not having it. And it was a bit of a heated argument there between. And we're all stood there going. And then we've seen the gaffer Reedy walk down the touchline going, who's going to win this one? Because no one's backing off. So I went, Baldy, I said, just let's do it for this trip. We'll drop off. No, we don't drop off. We're all the line. And that's how it went for about 5-10 minutes.
Yeah.
And the next thing, whistle went, read it. Right, everyone in. And that was it. Then they stopped the training session. So I don't know who ever won that argument. So,
I'm going to say Sacco.
But Sacco, that's Sacco down to a T, where doesn't matter about Steve Ball being at Arsenal for 10 years. You defend how Sacco wants you to defend.
Yeah.
And that's how it was. And that's how he'd put it on the plate. And Baldy loved Sacco. Absolutely loved him, because he'd never had anything like that at Arsenal.
Yeah.
And to come across Sacco like that, and it was brilliant watching them all. And that, I think that might be Sacco testing him to see what he was like.
See if he broke.
And then I played a few games, all the games of Baldy, really, until he got arthritis in his toe. And he had the longest big toe in the world. Like, it was funny because I've got that dude tonight when I do at the museum. And Gordon Ellis, the old physio, is coming along tonight. And there's many a morning we used to walk in the treatment room just to get some strappings on before training. And Baldy would lay on the bed with his foot up in the air, size 14 foot. And Gordon Ellis would have both his hands just rubbing his toe like that to try and get movement in it. And he couldn't train. He couldn't train certain days because it was so painful to put his foot in the boot. And then when they wheeled him out, as much as they did do Baldy, so much, learned so much off the guy.
That's the thing. I mean, you forget, we brought him in 500,000. I think he was 37.
Yeah.
And he played like a 21-year-old.
Yeah.
He was the best.
He was different class. It was his position. And I'll never forget their one-chop game at West Ham. We headbutted him.
Yeah.
And before the game, it's funny enough, it's a true story. Before the game, we're in the dressing room at West Ham. And there'd been something been said, I don't know, between certain players in the team. It might have been Baldy and somebody else off West Ham's team. I can't remember who it was. It might be De Canyard. I can't remember who it was. And Baldy was fired up, and I've never seen him like that. And we knew that so much had been said to him. So we've gone out on the pitch, and one chops up front, and first 20 minutes, tacking it, dropping off, doing this and whatever. I've gone to head a ball, cleared it. Next, all I heard was the biggest slap, the sound of a slap, and I've gone, looked across at far, and all the scene was one chops laid out on the floor. And I've gone, and I said to Chrissy Macon, "What's happened there?" And he went, "Didn't see it. I just heard the slap." So I turned around and said to Tommy, because the referee stopped it, I said to Tommy, "What happened there?" He went, "Baldy's lost it. He's just headbutted him." And I went, "He's headbutted it. It sounded like someone slapped someone's head. He was that loud." And Baldy, I went, "Why is he doing that, Baldy?" He went, "Keep standing on my toe. He just keeps standing on my toe, because he's got sore toes, hasn't he?" And I went, "That's not the only reason, is it?" And till this day, he tells you that was the reason, because his toes are that sore in games.
Yeah.
He kept backing into him and standing on his toes. And Baldy just had enough and headbutted him.
Yeah, I remember that.
I think we were 1-0 up, weren't we? And we drew one each, was it?
And Deitch give the ball away on the halfway line. Trevor Sinclair.
Because we played really well.
If we'd won, we would have been top of the league.
That's correct, yeah.
We would have been top.
We played really well, and with 10 men, they couldn't break us down. And
90th minute, I think it was.
And then afterwards, because all the London clubs we went to, we had to go to that Seven Sisters pub to meet about 5,000 Sunderland fans. It was brilliant. It was so good. Reedy made a point of us doing that. Going back to what we were doing before, is every London game we played, we knew we'd stay 2-3 hours afterwards to meet the fans. And we had to go off to this pub, and there'd be 2,000 or 3,000 waiting for us there. And we'd be drinking, having a chat with them, mixing it, and Reedy, 8 o'clock, right, everyone on the bus, we're off back up the road.
And I remember, because I remember I was a kid. I mean, I'm about 13, 14. And I used to go and try and meet the players and afterwards get autographs. And you know what's funny? My mum still speaks about it now. She's like, every player made sure that signed every autograph. There was no... Mickey Gray.
We were told to, in a way. Not like really gets you in on your contract, right? In your contract, you've got to sign every...
Yeah.
You follow what the other lads were doing. So when I first arrived, they seen everyone coming out the training ground, the old training ground, everyone stopping the cars, and you'd be about an hour in the car waiting for it to sign an autograph. You made sure you'd sign everything.
Yeah.
Because they're stood there in the rain, they're stood there in the cold, they're the supporters, it's their club when we leave. End of the day, 20 years from now, I can still come back, but it's still the same fans supporting, it's their club with their kids. You just got to come back to support it. But no, Reedy made a point of, no matter where we went, away from home, especially in London, down south, we stayed and signed the autographs that was needed.
Talking about good games, because we've talked about the Chelsea game before, but there's one game that I actually completely forgot about, in a sense, towards that season. And I don't know how I forgot about it, but the Newcastle game in the rain.
Yeah, yeah.
So early in the season. And
yeah,
I mean, I don't know quite how to word the question, but just what were your memories of the day?
The memories of the day was getting absolutely drenched. First time of seeing how high the Sunderland fans were putting the top tiers, and it was like, but you could hear them.
The
big, massive paper talk of Shearer and Hullett and all this, and Ferguson and all this, and Reedy was just basically, can whoever's playing up front, they're going to be good players, so don't worry about who's playing. This was all talk. And then to go out, and playing them conditions for one, which today wouldn't have been played.
Wouldn't have been played.
Iconic Kev goal again. Do you know what I mean? He's turned and flipped. Everyone's thinking he's going to cross it in the box and put it in there. But just, it was wearing. I know it sounds stupid in a way. And the only thing that ever sticks to me, we didn't get to wear white shorts a lot.
Yeah.
And in that game, we wore white shorts. Do you know what I mean? And it's the iconic. Quinn is celebrating, but his shorts are virtually that long down his ankles. He's because how wet they are. And me and Bolly looking at each other, do you know, going, we ain't got the energy to run down there and celebrate. We'll just stay up here because really always wanted you to celebrate with each other. And that was the iconic. And Quinny was putting his hands in the air and shirts never fitted him. So it was up here around his waist, around his chest. And just the, and looking at Mickey Gray more than anything else. And there was a, we had an old physio of a masseur called Mickey Holland.
Apparently the massive Newcastle guy.
Oh, yeah. Apparently biggest Newcastle guy. Fan ever. Massive Newcastle fan. He had a massive Newcastle tattoo on his right calf that he never wore short. He wore shorts all week, come match day, tracky bottoms, right? And he always tried to protect it away from the fans, but they didn't ever go at him over it. But the funniest guy you're ever going to meet in your life. And that was another one. He was Reedy's chauffeur. He was like, wherever Reedy, we used to say to him, go on, Gaffer wants a cup of tea, go and do it. And he'd go off and do his stuff and all that. But he was a massive Newcastle fan. And on that day, sitting on the Sunderland bench, he must, and even he come in at the end of the game and went, do you know what I mean? Being a Newcastle fan, you deserved it.
Yeah.
But you've done us all a favour because now obviously he might leave tomorrow.
Yeah, he did as well.
Yeah, he went there. He was around the next day, didn't he?
Yeah.
Because they brought Shearer and Duncan at the end, didn't they, to try and get some out of the game, didn't they?
And that's the one thing that people always talk about that, and they talk about, and even from the day it happened, people talk about, oh, if he started with Shearer and stuff like that. They were 1-0 up.
Correct.
And then they brought Ferguson on, we equalised. Yeah. Then they brought Shearer on, and then we got the winner. Yeah,
correct.
So technically, they lost on the game.
And that's what they say, and they can only answer that, is do you think they've chucked it in for him? I don't know, because they had issues with him, but only they can answer that. I don't know. Don't get involved in all that, but it was a strange scenario to bring him on. But no, great memories. Great memories of beating Newcastle at St. James's Park, which is good.
So true, you all went out after that as well.
We'd had a few, yeah. Which really made you have a few. He was, not made you have a few, but he was, when you win, you celebrate.
Yeah.
And, but make sure we've got a game in 3 days, kind of scenario and that. So, mate, if you're not ready, hey, and in training was tough.
Yeah.
Training was tough. If you go out the night before and think you get away with training, there's only one person that could do that, and that's Alex Ray.
Yeah.
And he got away for about 2 or 3 years. Yeah. So, but no, it was tough and it was hard and it was tough, but you couldn't pull the wool over Sacco's, and because they had spies everywhere.
Yeah.
They knew when every player was out.
The season after that, obviously we finished 7th. I think when you think back of that season, well, still frustration that we could have...
Yeah.
We should have been in Europe.
Yeah, we should have. I think we only won one at last 8 games. There was something like that.
Something like that.
I always remember fans when I was still playing here said that we chucked it in, or something on them lines. In one of the fanzines, there was a fanzine that was going out, and they were saying that we've chucked it in. We could have qualified. We tried everything we could to qualify, and Reedy did. And sometimes momentum don't get you in there.
Yeah,
but the thing is, we had the golden boot guy in the squad, which is a massive achievement for us. We beat some big teams on the way in the season. As an achievement to go into Europe, was we ready for Europe? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. That could have been a different hurdle for Reedy to sign more players at the time. And I don't know. So we never got it, but I couldn't tell you on that one. So I think Reedy had a squad for the Premier League and maybe a cup or two, but not probably...
Not for a full.
But I know Reedy wanted to manage in Europe in a sense. So
yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. It's just sometimes results go...
Just reminded me of that season as well. I think it was Kevin Phillips said a few times, the biggest noise he's ever heard at a football ground was when he equalised against Newcastle at the Stadium Light.
Yeah,
it
was
2-2.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you remember the game?
Yeah.
How loud was that on the pitch? Because I remember
it was loud. And that was when the Newcastle fans were behind the goal, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They got put behind the goal. So where they've been moved up to, the away fans now is at the top, but they put behind the goal. And I always like when you've got away fans, you can see them. It makes the atmosphere... But no, it was. But you could feel it coming in. It was an atmosphere in the game coming in during the day. And I remember in the first 5 minutes, I smashed Alan Shearer in the far corner in front of the Sunderland fans. As I turned around to look at the Sunderland fans, they were grown men just like punching the chest, like, and trying on going, that gets you up for it straight away because you just done Alan. I didn't mean to do him. I just smashed him in the corner. Referee didn't even see it. So, and she had got up. Unbelievable pro. Just went, well, I shrugged his shoulders and went on with it.
Yeah.
So got me back later on in the game, but he was one of them. And that was my 5 minutes at home going to the Sunderland fans. This is what this team's going to be about today. They were still the so-called the big team, weren't they?
Yeah.
They thought they was, even though we had better players in our team. But
yeah, much better.
It was good, but good colours on the day. Do you want me to see red and white v black and white? He said, no, it's like my Man City playing Man United, blue v the red.
Such a clash.
But then you've got the Newcastle fans behind the goal in their tops. It does that, and move them up there might be policing. I don't know, but I still like fans.
Part of you kind of misses it, and I think there's a few fans that doesn't really like them up there.
Gives you
it does. It's like I used to always sit right next to the away. I was always in Southwest corner, me, so it was always right next to them, and it was horrible when they score. And there's been many bad memories of it, but other way around,
great atmosphere. But no, it can generate some noise.
Yeah,
that stadium when it was, and I was lucky. I had 3.5 years of it, so it was a pleasure to. Playing the 3.5 years, when it come to me leaving, it was something that really didn't want me to do.
Yeah.
But I got to a point where I'd been injured and they brought Big Stan in, the centre half.
Stan Varga.
Yeah, Stan, me and Stan had played. Jody come in, I was injured, Jody come in, but then he went to sign Emerson Tom.
Emerson Tom.
And it's the most, I love him to bits. He's an agent and I do things for him and he just helps me out with stuff. So he's different class.
Where is he now, Emerson Tom?
He's back in Portugal, but he's doing stuff for agencies in Brazil and all around. So I can give you his number if you want him.
Love Emerson Tom.
Em was Cold different
hero,
class. Em was different class, but at the time I was saying to Reedy, I'm back in two weeks. Don't. And he needed to sign a centre half. He come in. And done well in the first 4 or 5 games, done well. And I've sat on the bench for 4 or 5 games. The back four's keeping clean sheets, so I can't knock on the gaffer's door and say, why am I not involved? They were keeping clean sheets. But the way I've been brought up and the principles I brought, I needed to play.
Yeah.
And I was playing reserve games, which he didn't want me to play in, the gaffer at the time. I was playing down at York. They used to play the reserve games down there, some games. And there was 4 or 5 championship clubs coming from me, Bolton, Blackburn, Wolves, wanting me to go out on loan. Went to the gaffer and he went, I'll let you go, but you're only going for a month and I want a recall because I might need you back. So I went out, played, loved it at Wolves, come back, still won't let me go, even though I was trying to say, I'm not in your, you are in my plans, I've got no time to let you go, I need 4 centre-halves, you're one of the 4, so on. Me pushing it and wanting to play first team football, not wanting to sit on the bench, and I was 29, I think, at the time, 28. It wasn't for me in the sense of just sitting there. I couldn't pick up my money every week and justify got to play at York or Durham in a reserve game. I didn't, and he knew that and he was putting me off a free off. We had backwards and forwards arguments. Sacco was coming to me. I had Big Quinny saying to me, but I needed to play. And in hindsight, is it the right move for me? Yeah, because I went on and done great stuff with Wolves and I enjoyed my times and promoted in the Premiership. If I hung on for another month, Emerson got injured in the next 3 games and I could have been back in. Hey, it's hindsight.
These things happen, don't
they? Yeah, and I went on and I went on to Leeds after that. So you never know, do you know what I mean? It was one of them where I really enjoyed my time. I enjoyed my 3.5 years. My missus and the kids were born in Manchester but brought up here. They were babies.
Yeah.
Loved it up here. Absolutely loved it up here. It was, if you speak to my missus now, she'd move back tomorrow.
Yeah.
She'd move back tomorrow. She lived in Durham. Kids know bits about it, but they understand. But Mrs. loved it, absolutely loved it.
Paul, thank you very much.
No problem, pleasure.
Perfect.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.